Первые дни осени не порадуют.
Сильный дожди, штормовой ветер теперь вам
облачно. Первый осенний день сохранится тепло.
Но в Москве сильные дожди.
It's the last day of August. Summer's over, and there are storm clouds on the horizon. Russia's political season is set to resume after a summer recess that was anything but quiet. And the autumn promises to be an even wilder ride. Local and regional elections are scheduled for October, including a bellwether race in the Moscow suburb of Khimki, where environmental activist Yevgeny Chirikova is planning to run for mayor. The opposition, meanwhile, is holding its first ever online primary to choose a new council that will coordinate its protest and electoral activity. Mass anti-government demonstrations are also in the works. The ruling United Russia Party, meanwhile, is preparing a series of tough new measures to crack down on dissent, including one bill that would outlaw blasphemy and another that would make it easier to prosecute Kremlin critics who post anonymous comments on the internet. And the country's ruling elite remains divided as ever, with a growing critical mass increasingly uncomfortable with the emerging hard line. And adding to the general vibe of upheaval, persistent rumors have been appearing in the Russian media that President Vladimir Putin is considering sacking Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev in the coming months. And amid all this, the government is preparing a major reform of Russia's creaking social welfare system, which could stoke massive discontent among the underclass, even as the new middle class is in open revolt. Russia's gathering political storm. How hard will it hit, and what will it leave in its wake? Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. My regular co-host, Kirill Coburn, is off for a couple weeks. But on the line from New York City to pick up his mantle is veteran Russia watcher Mark Galeotti, professor of global affairs at New York University and the author of one of my favorite Russia blogs, In Moscow Shadows. Mark is also the author and editor of numerous books on Russia and writes the regular Moscow news column, Siloviks and Scoundrels. Welcome back, Mark. It's always good to see you. And thanks to Skype, I can actually see you.
Exactly. Technology is wonderful, isn't it?
It sure is. Without it, we couldn't do this podcast. Mark, I've been hearing it from my Russian colleagues. I've been reading about it in the Russian press over and over. It's going to be a very hot autumn. But as I noted in my intro, there are so many disparate elements at work here, so many moving parts. To get things rolling, can these things be pulled together into a coherent theme? Will it be a season of rebellion, a season of repression, a season of chaos, a season of reform, all of the above, none of the above? What's your take?
I think it's going to be a season of decisions. I think this is something that we've already discussed in the podcast, which is that August, for all kinds of reasons, not least the fact that it's Dacha month, it's cucumber month, is a time in which actually Putin can, and frankly did, stay out of the fray and was actually quite sort of dangerously absent. We can talk about some of the implications of that later. But that cannot continue, particularly, as you say, because we have elections coming up and so forth. So I think September is going to start a time in which they're actually going to have to resolve a lot of these issues they've allowed to slide for a while. Now, that means that obviously the opposition is going to be pressing, that various factions within the government are going to be pressing. You know, it could well be many of the other things that you mentioned. But for me, the key theme is exactly having to make decisions.
And what do you see being on the table? What key issues do you think are on the table right now where these decisions are going to have to be made?
Well, I would say that there's basically three. One is, and I know we're going to be discussing Medvedev, his future and his past later on, but one is precisely the issue of the prime ministership. Who's going to be prime minister, but also just what the job involves. They still haven't actually worked out quite what the new tandem means. The second key decision is actually about what to do with the opposition, and this is going to be an interactive one. It's also quite how the opposition plan to move on. Are they simply going to try and do the same thing but continued, or are they actually going to try and sort of move further? And I think this is why, you know, I think you're absolutely right to raise the Khimki issue, because this is going to be one of their sort of set piece attempts to see that they can actually translate people power and pageantry on the streets into political movement. And the third key area of decision is actually going to be about financial policy. There's a whole variety of questions, everything from pension reform onwards, that needs to be addressed. There are some potential issues to do with, you know, inflation that is actually relatively high compared to GDP growth and so forth. But again, it means that hard decisions are going to have to be made on that.
And they're also going to be raising utilities prices come fall, which is not going to be popular. And a lot of analysts think that this could... Right now, the regime's problem is with the so-called new middle class, the creative class, the urban middle class. But these utilities price hikes and pension reform and other social reforms that are coming, this could bring the lower classes into revolt for entirely different reasons than the middle classes in revolt. This could this create a perfect storm, or could, do you think, I mean, during the election, Putin was very, very skilled. Or at least his handlers were very, very skilled at playing the lower classes and the rural areas and outside, you know, rural Russia against Moscow or provincial Russia against Moscow. You know, these spoiled brats in Moscow on the streets, and they were able to milk that meme for a while, and it did seem to work for them. Will they be able to continue to play this card if you have the lower classes and the rural discontent as well into the picture?
Well, they may. And this is what I mean about the extent to which, interestingly enough, a lot of the decisions that Putin and co. are going to have to make will very much be framed by their opposition. It could easily be that you end up just simply with a disgruntled working class, precisely because utility prices have gone up, other prices are going up, their pensions are going down. You know, let's face it, pension reform never means we want to give you more money sooner. But on the other hand, still suspicious of what they see as effete hipsters in the cities. There need not be that connection. And I think this is it. I think precisely that will be one of the key questions for the Kremlin, how to keep that barrier between them. But on the other hand, I mean, and to an extent we saw it in previous elections in places like Yaroslavl, is when you actually have people who go out and articulate the big meta issues that largely motivate the urban middle class, but do so in a way that precisely speaks to the interests of a wider electorate, that says, look, you know, it's because of bad government decisions, it's because of corruption, it's because of all these kind of issues that your situation is now the way it is, then I think there is a real danger for the Kremlin that these two parties can connect. So I think it's a possibility. But on the other hand, it's something that the opposition is going to have to do actively. They can't just assume that it'll work out that way.
Well, let's turn to the opposition, because you mentioned three things. We're going to have a whole second segment on Medvedev. We'll touch on him a little bit in the first section. But let's go to the opposition here. There's something interesting on the table come October, and that are these so-called online primaries that are being organized by the United Opposition. Navalny has been putting out instructional videos about how these are going to take place. The website's up. They have their own kind of electoral commission that is ensuring fairness in this. And they're going to elect a 45-member coordinating council. Five seats on that council are going to be reserved for liberals, five seats reserved for nationalists, and five seats reserved for leftists. And then there's going to be 30 at-large seats. Now, this council is supposed to, in theory, be deciding who runs in which local elections as a unified opposition candidate. It's going to be deciding when and where to hold protests, what kind of issues to back and get behind. Is this a step forward for the opposition, do you think? Or are we going to start to see the same old opposition chaos of not being able to get anything done and not being able to agree on anything, and all the schisms and so on that have been historically associated with the Russian opposition?
Again, I'm going to give that terribly wishy-washy answer of saying it could be. It's absolutely a necessary precondition, precisely because, I mean, although one has to be slightly skeptical about even the term the unified opposition, you know, we'll see how that actually plays out in reality. It's easy to be unified when there's nothing at stake, when you're not really having to make hard policy and other decisions. We'll see how it gets how far the unity survives. But, I mean, nonetheless, yes, it was necessary to try and bring some order to the movement. This was one of the issues. I think it was so clear around the time of the presidential elections that they were very good at just sort of creating a feel-good power on the streets and bringing in sort of people. But that never really had any kind of genuine political traction. the boring, necessary, hard work of political movement, the people spending all night in back rooms hammering out deals, the people who are going to go out distributing leaflets and such like. You know, all that still had to be done. So this is a necessary step towards that, absolutely. The problem is, okay, how do you operationalize that? How does that actually affect things on the streets? You know, what real authority is this committee going to have? I think, again, it's one of these things, it's going to have to assert and claim and build that legitimacy. If it can do it, it'll actually be quite a dangerous force for the Kremlin. But the track record so far is that we can't necessarily assume that it's guaranteed.
Right. In the best case scenario, it could almost be like a shadow government. And in the worst case scenario, we're going to see a lot of what we've always seen with the Russian opposition. I guess the test case really is Himki in October.
Mm. I think so. I mean, and I think this parallel that you drew with the shadow government is important because Russia has not had an opposition movement. It's had parties like the communists and so forth who have fulfilled that ritual role, but have never really regarded themselves as an opposition. To be honest, they've never really striven for power.
Right.
And therefore, I think this is one of the things that by just having such a committee, and particularly by having that committee step up and begin to speak like an opposition, and by which it means there have to be policies. There have to be more than just slogans saying, you know, Russia without Putin. There has to be, well, okay, this is what we want in a practical way. It's also beginning to educate Russians just the very concept that democracy also implies plurality.
Mm-hmm.
Himki will be an interesting case. But in some ways, I'm more interested in how this might play out in lower prestige, lower profile areas where you haven't got a particularly famous figure as the opposition candidate around whom a lot of effort and interest will cohere.
Another thing I'm kind of looking for is, and it's we've said on the podcast numerous times, I've written on the blog numerous times, little unites the opposition other than an opposition to Putin, other than that Putin must go. And again, if you look at the two kind of most high profile figures, Alexei Navalny on the right and Sergei Udaltsov on the left, yeah, they don't agree on much after that. But there is one thing they could agree on, and that's some rules of the game. That's some rules of the game, that if we take charge, we're going to have fair elections. And if I lose, I'm going to step down, Alexei, and let you run the show for a little while. And when you screw up, I'm going to be ready to come in. And when I screw up, you should be ready to come in. And so they should set a precedent. This has never been done in Russia before, where you had agreement that we disagree. And it would, with those two, it could be quite powerful because they are so they represent such different constituencies, but that we're going to agree on some rules of the game. Do you think that is that realistic? Is that pie in the sky? Or do you think this crew could actually, because if they don't agree on that, then let's face it, we're in for the same old cycle no matter what happens, right?
Hmm. Yeah, I think we do have a fairly sort of historic window that is open at the moment, because I think both Navalny and Udaltsov, I mean, as you say, in many ways at opposite ends of the political spectrum, but if we think of it as almost as in a three-dimensional terms, they are, on the other hand, still away from the current ossified model of Russian politics. It would be inordinately powerful if they could make it clear, and this is going back to this whole business of actually educating ordinary Russians about the concept of opposition, educating ordinary Russians to what they have a right to expect from their political system, and putting in a position in which other people who want to start competing in the political arena also have to sort of sign up to this notion. But I would just actually throw in one thing. There is one other thing on which they can agree. That is corruption. I mean, I really wouldn't want to underplay the extent to which I think corruption still, for me, is the key issue which will both cohere an opposition against the current regime, but also allow a middle-class opposition to reach out to a potential working-class opposition and say, look, we do have something in common. We do have something that hurts us all. So I think one can put together corruption and the rules of the game, which begins to form some kind of a platform which is inclusive, not exclusive.
Right. It seems to go beyond the slogans, and it could unite this urban middle class and the underclass, both of which could be partners in discontent very soon. Now, moving from the opposition, the other side, as you said, this is an interactive process. Then we have the authorities. And the authorities right now are far from united. I mean, it's been, there's always lots of pieces in the Russian media about how the elite is divided. These pieces have proliferated in the last couple of weeks. I'll read you some quotes that I've come across in the Russian media right now. The authorities are only thinking about how to keep everything from blowing up. That's Olga Krishnovskaya, a noted sociologist of the Russian Academy of Sciences, one of the most astute and connected observers of the elite. The ground is burning under the feet of the elite. The political system has reached the state of instability. Real fragmentation is taking place by generation because Medvedev, and we'll get to Medvedev later, has rejuvenated the administrative system. Many observers think that these leaders, meaning those younger people in the elite associated with Medvedev, are actually giving support to the opposition. The others have pointed, and Stanislav Belkovsky, another noted follower of the elite, has noted that the elite is kind of divided over whether to crack down. There's a lot of people in the elite that are very uncomfortable with the crackdown right now. Mm-hmm. An interesting quote from Belkovsky out of a new story in Gazette Ru this week: the crackdown is aimed at bringing reality into line with Putin's psychological state. Putin, above all, wants stability, but he's also offended that the opposition doesn't appreciate his concessions on reform, on things like election of governors. So you have a pretty volatile situation at the top as well. How do you see that playing out? And is this issue resolvable at all? Because you have, and again, we've divided them in many ways. Olga Krishnovskaya has said it broke it down along generations and said a lot of the people siding with reform are younger people that were brought in with Medvedev. We have kind of broken it down in the power vertical between managers and shareholders. The shareholders like Igor Sechin that have a stake in collecting oil rents don't want anything to change. Managers like Surkov and like Alexei Kudrin, they understand that something's got to change. It's been Siloviki and technocrats. Do you see, however you couch this divide, and it's really different ways of saying the same thing in a lot of ways, however you couch this divide, is this bridgeable?
I don't think it is, unless something emerged which provides a similar cohering factor for the elite, which I can't see. So I can't see suddenly, I don't know, sort of Navalny saying we will be stringing up all chinovniki and their families from lampposts when we come to power or anything like that. Right. He's astute enough, just ask the board of Aeroflot, to know that he's able to sort of to operate in a variety of different settings and worlds. What we're seeing at the moment, I think, is a particular high point in the division within the elite. If you think of it, it's a rising curve, but it's a jagged curve. And to a large extent, it's precisely because Putin has been so absent for the past couple of months, such that, again, something that we've discussed on previous podcasts, it means that a whole variety of different groups and institutions are trying to push their own policies. And there is just, I think, I pick up a sense of precisely rudderlessness and a sense of, you know, generalized concern within the elite, which forces everyone to think, well, you know, what's my particular escape route? What's my particular plan? But that, I don't believe, is going to continue. I mean, I think it can't continue. Putin has to start sort of putting in some sort of clear sense of leadership. So that, we might say, is likely to damp down some of the overt expressions of this division, because it'll suddenly become dangerous. Once the Tsar rules on what the right line is, it becomes dangerous to talk against that. But it doesn't mean that people aren't going to be thinking that. It doesn't mean that in boardrooms, in office rooms, and around the kitchen table, people aren't going to be saying all these kinds of things. I think that the dissolution, the fragmentation of the elite is irreversible. Mm-hmm. The question is, in a way, what directions does it go in? And I think this issue of a generational one is important. I mean, I don't think it's purely generational. I think you're right that there's kind of a whole variety of different ways of dividing the elite. But on the other hand, the extent to which precisely there is clearly fractions within the elite who either are directly sympathetic to the opposition or else their kids are. Mm-hmm. You know, they have a personal stake. Right. Right. In what's going on. So they're not willing to actually see some massive and dramatic crackdown.
There was an interest, going back to Stanislav Belkovsky, he drew a very interesting metaphor in a piece this week where he said that to the not only to the creative class, but to part of the elite, the technocratic, the kind of reformist wing of the elite. Putin is like he's become like a boring husband. And a boring husband can bring his wife flowers and chocolates and do everything for her and be the best possible husband in the world. But she's still going to think he's boring. They're tired of him. And that there's really nothing, and that Putin, and what I drew from this is Putin's completely lost his position as the honest broker. If part of the elite views him, it's one thing for the creative class to view him this way. But the elite, and this part of the elite is kind of part of that class, or as an adjunct of that class, or as you said, their kids are part of this class. So if Putin's no longer the broker, then what is that boat?
If you think about the sort of the classic ways that any state or any ruler take power, it's usually a mix. It's legitimacy, it's co-optation because this person is useful, and it's coercion. And in the past, especially within the elite, Putin had all three. If you messed with him, that's when the tax police would come and kick down your door. But on the other hand, there were people who thought, well, you know, he's a strong leader, a powerful leader. Compared with Yeltsin, he knows the way we should be going. He had legitimacy. And also, you know, from the point of view of the elite, he was very, very good for them. They prospered dramatically. What we're seeing now is that, I mean, he's still got, in Bastrykin and others, the door kickers.
Right.
That's not the question. Legitimacy, in many ways, was lost with the whole castling process. And certainly the way he's handled himself since, he has lost that luster, that magic of divine right. And in terms of cooptation, again, I think it becomes very dangerous for any ruler, at the point at which even those close to him are thinking, okay, is he useful to me today? Will he be useful to me tomorrow? And at what point will actually he become a liability? So, I mean, I think, you know, this is it. Putin has descended from the clouds. He's become a mere mortal like everyone else. And as such, every day he effectively has to prove his value to the elite. And at the moment, he's not doing so. It's hard to know quite what's going on, whether he really feels that it's best to keep away from the fray, whether he has no idea what to do, whether he just simply thinks that this is a brief little squall that will soon die down. But one way or the other, he is not there asserting himself, and he is not there demonstrating to the elite that he's good for them.
And he's also now associated with one side of the elite. He is no longer the decider. He's no longer the broker. He's no longer the arbiter. And that was really the key variable, I thought, in his indispensability.
Yeah. And again, I think sort of the way it had emerged was in often cases that Putin was not seen as on the side of the more liberal technocratic elements. But on the other hand, within the context of the old tandem, by the very fact that he was willing to give Medvedev the scope to fulfill that role, mm-hmm. And we talked about the collective Putin, the deep state or whatever, was able precisely to maintain that role as the seemingly neutral arbiter. This is the other thing, by basically keeping Medvedev at arm's length, by allowing there to be discussion about replacing him, Putin has once again made it clear that he is on one end of this particular political spectrum. And really, he has a diminishing number of contacts. He's lost Kudrin. Medvedev is no longer particularly effective. I mean, actually, even just simply the personal connections he has.
He's lost Surkov.
Well, Surkov, exactly, again. For all these reasons, he's increasingly sort of barricading himself in one side of the whole sort of divide.
In a few moments, we're going to zero in on this theme of the tandem and how it in tandem 2.0 and how it's working out. If Dmitry Medvedev is really on the way out, what will be his legacy? I'd like to remind you that you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. On the line with me from New York City is Mark Galliotti, professor of global politics at New York University and author of numerous books on Russia. I'd also like to remind you that you can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL. You can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
As I complete my work as head of state, I want to thank everyone who has supported me all these years. I thank you for your immense trust and your help. I am glad that Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin will become president today. He is an experienced person and a strong leader who is supported by the majority of our country's citizens.
That, of course, was Dmitry Medvedev speaking at Vladimir Putin's inauguration back on May 7th. It also may have been Medvedev's political swan song. Barely 4 months after Medvedev turned the Kremlin over to his one-time mentor to become prime minister, it's become clear that Tandem 2.0 is working less smoothly than the earlier version. There have been persistent reports in the press that the relationship between Putin and Medvedev has become increasingly distant and increasingly strained, and that the president is considering firing Medvedev in the coming months. Mark, we of course don't know if these rumors are true, but what we do know is that Putin and Medvedev's teams are increasingly incapable of working together, reflecting this broader split in the elite that we talked about earlier in the podcast. But if Medvedev is really on the way out, what do you see? Does he have a legacy? What do you see as his legacy?
I think he actually has a very important legacy. It's very difficult, and I must admit, it was really quite charming and also depressing listening to his breathless encomium to Vladimir Putin just then. It's very easy to mock Medvedev. I mean, he was not the most effective, not the most charismatic of presidents. But if you look at the changes that took place on his watch, and the extent to which, you know, the chickens that are coming home to roost were all hatched by Medvedev, historically speaking, we might well find out that if Putin does lose power, it probably won't be first and foremost because of Navalny or Udaltsov or whatever, but actually it will have been Medvedev who brought him down by the very processes that were unleashed during his presidency.
Yeah, it was almost that his legacy is this period we're seeing now because of his weakness, almost. Not in spite of it, but because of it. He was able to activate the side of the elite that he was supposed to be representing. And it's almost a case of be careful what you wish for, you might get it, because Putin seems to have put Medvedev in place to kind of give voice to that side of the elite. But yet now he doesn't really like the voices he's hearing from that side of the elite. How costly would it be for Putin to dismiss Medvedev? What are the pros and cons here that you see in keeping Medvedev or dismissing him?
I think that the cons are diminishing in the sense of I don't think it will be excessively expensive. When Medvedev was made prime minister at the time, and it's always, always, always dangerous to ever give kind of specific predictions with Russia, but at the time I thought he had about 6 months in him. 6 months consolation prime ministership before he's sent off with some sort of golden parachute to some nice location, whether, you know, rector of a university or whatever. And coincidentally enough, that would take us through to November after the elections. So, you know, it could well be that if the elections go badly, that becomes an excuse. There are people whom Medvedev represents. And to lose them would, I think, be a blow to Putin. But to be honest, I'm not sure if Putin sees it in those terms. I'm struck in some ways by the fact that Putin doesn't really understand the new arithmetic of power, I think, within the elite. The question becomes, who replaces Medvedev? If Medvedev is treated well, so that Putin can at least seem to still be a decent patron, and if he can put someone in place who is at least a kind of a credible interlocutor. I mean, once upon a time, Kudrin was one of the obvious candidates. Yeah. I think that's becoming harder and harder to see. Then that's one thing. But on the other hand, if we get someone like Rogozin, who is an interesting, able, intelligent, and often quite fun character, but definitely would never be described as being on the liberal wing of elite politics.
No.
on the other hand, again, that would represent a further barricading of the Kremlin. And therefore, I think it would actually accelerate the loss of that portion of the elite.
I think the key choice right now, if Medvedev is going to be replaced, and again, this is speculative, but if Medvedev is going to be replaced, the key choice is between a real prime minister and a technical prime minister. Mm-hmm. If you have a technical prime minister like like Fradkov was, like Zubkov was, for example, in Putin's first stint in the Kremlin. I mean, you never heard from these guys. It was basically the prime minister's office, the government, became an adjunct of the Kremlin, of the president's office, essentially. They could go that way, and that would also represent somewhat of a barricading of the Kremlin. If you were to give it to a strong figure, to a real prime minister, and that could go, if it goes in the reform, and I agree with you, it's increasingly unlikely, if it goes in the reformist direction, to somebody like a Kudrin, or the more likely, if it goes in the more reactionary direction, like a Rogozin, that both of those carry risks, because you're going to have a strong figure who's not going to be a technical prime minister in that position. So this is, and again, what are the pros and cons of that choice for Putin and the ruling elite, given the context of everything we see going on right now?
Well, the pros for Putin, if he manages to actually get his head around the idea of employing a strong prime minister, is precisely that actually he begins to create once again at least the illusion of change, but also of choice within the existing political structure. There is that sense of, well, you know, if you don't like what Putin says, that's okay because he's moderated by the prime minister. The trouble, I think, is firstly just simply psychological. I'm not convinced that Putin, I mean, is willing to accept the notion of a strong prime minister. He didn't have one under Medvedev, after all. But secondly, for this prime minister to then be real, the prime minister has to sometimes disagree with the president. And I think at this stage, that could also be tremendously corrosive. I mean, again, you know, to pull this back to the issues of the legacies of Medvedev, one of the interesting things is precisely that both Putin and Medvedev often talk the talk of the rule of law and the importance of a law-based state. I see very, very little evidence that Putin believes in it. Putin believes the law is just simply there as the mechanism to ensure that the state machine works, except when he reaches down and tweaks and bends and breaks it. Mm-hmm. I honestly believe that Medvedev actually was a true supporter of the notion that there should be a law-based state, and that sometimes those laws will foil the government, that sometimes the government must be subordinated to that. And therefore, I mean, he introduced this rhetoric, this whole strand of opinion, which is now tripping up Putin. Well, likewise, you know, any new prime minister, if it's a strong prime minister, if it's a prime minister with ideas who's willing to articulate that, by articulating those ideas begins to force Putin into either destroying or challenging him, or accepting limitations on his freedom of maneuver. So, I mean, again, I think we're at this point, and, you know, I'm not saying it's going to be 6 months, I'm not even necessarily saying it's going to be 6 years, but I do think the rot has set in, that I don't think there is anything Putin can do to prevent the process. He can accelerate in all kinds of ways. But I think if I were Putin, I would probably be going for the technocratic, quiet prime minister. Not because I think it's going to turn around the situation, but because I think that probably at least gives you an easier time and maybe sort of allows you to hold on to power for a bit longer. I think actually having a strong prime minister in the short term might look like a bold, crowd-pleasing statement. But in the longer term, I think we'd just simply further deepen the fissures we're seeing within the elite.
Now, what about Medvedev himself? I've been seeing he's been conspicuously absent from the news, but the things that have been popping up have raised my eyebrows a little bit, for example. Mm. He recently signed a decree that workers in state corporations have to report their income. Putin was reportedly not very happy with this, but he did it anyway. And then he went on vacation. Medvedev did. And he went on vacation, and traditionally when the prime minister goes on vacation, he assigns a deputy to run the government in his absence. Medvedev didn't do this. He said, I will take care of all the paperwork from my vacation. It'll be a working vacation. These were seen as signs that Medvedev is trying to find some independent space. He seems to expect that he might be getting fired in the near future. And he's setting himself up for maybe a post-prime ministership political career. Do you see that in the offing?
He may well be thinking in those terms. I'm not convinced that it's actually a realistic prospect. But I certainly agree that there is that sense that he almost seems demob happy. He almost seems to feel that he knows he's going, so why bother playing the role? It's quite interesting. If you remember, a little while back, he had a cabinet spat with his defense minister, Serdyukov, in which he said, the guy responsible for these decisions ought to be sacked. And Serdyukov said, well, that was me. And was more or less making a look, so what are you going to do about it statement?
Right.
Because he knew full well that Medvedev couldn't and wouldn't actually do anything against him without clearing it with Putin. And he knew that Putin was still backing him.
Right.
And I think it's actually sort of an accumulation of events like that that I think have actually, again, we're just speculating, but pushed Medvedev over the line. And so, again, I think that he feels that he has no real future within this current regime. He's waiting precisely to get the right deal and to be pushed rather than to jump. But, yeah, I think there's a part of him that is hoping to build some kind of post-government role. And I'm sure Kudrin's example is in his mind. But there's also, I think, just a part of him that just is fed up. He has been a very good soldier. Go back to that encomium that you played at the beginning. Not only was he messed about by Putin, but he then had to go on national television and say, this is the best thing for Russia.
Right.
I'm not as good as him. And I think he's had enough.
Yeah, no, he's allowed himself to kind of be turned into a joke. And there was a time when he was the informal leader of the technocratic wing of the elite. And he's somebody that people were actually placing their hopes in and were deeply disappointed. And these people were deeply disappointed in him when he decided to step aside. Of course, he didn't decide. It was decided for him. And what I'm beginning to reading between the lines in all this is that the prime ministership was his price for stepping aside without a fight. One has to wonder, counterfactual histories are a dime a dozen, but one has to wonder if Putin isn't wondering, wouldn't it have been a better idea to put Sergei Ivanov in the president's role, in the interim presidency role between 2008 and 2012? Because the logic at the time was that Putin wanted to put a weak figure like Medvedev in, because if he put in Ivanov is basically a carbon copy of Putin in a lot of ways, and that he's probably going to get ideas and he's going to have the strength. If he decides he wants to stay in, he could potentially put the bureaucratic muscle together to go ahead and do it. He put Medvedev in because he was weak, but by virtue of A, Medvedev's weakness, and B, like you pointed out, that he really does believe in a law-governed state, and he got all these things into the political bloodstream that are still there about a law-governed state, activating the side of the elite that actually believes in these things, he's becoming more of a problem to Putin, perhaps, than Ivanov would have become. What do you think?
I think that's very astute, actually. The interesting thing is that, okay, all the various underlying dynamics which are bringing these current problems to a head for Putin, particularly in terms of the impact of economic change and therefore the creation and rise of a middle class, that would have happened regardless. But the sad truth of the matter is authoritarian regimes tend to stay in power so long as they're willing to remain authoritarian. It's precisely when they start to get touchy-feely and when they want to sort of try and reach out and when they effectively allow the unity of the governing system to begin to break apart, that's when they become vulnerable. I mean, Lenin understood this. He said that one of the key things about a successful revolution is there has to be a critical absence of will on the part of the elite to maintain their power. Certainly, I can't see someone like Ivanov ever having had that critical absence of will. In that context, Russia would have been a different and less pleasant place with Ivanov or a similar figure as interim president. But on the other hand, I think in this alternative world, Putin at this point would be having a much, much easier life than he is now. It is exactly because he thought, this is classic Putin. He thinks he can actually activate civil society when it's useful and then put back the box and constrain it when it's not. And he doesn't realize that he doesn't work that way. You know, we're back to the whole parallel of genies in bottles and such like.
Right. And I'm going back to Bilkovsky's quote that the crackdown is aimed at bringing reality into line with Putin's psychological state. And this is something Kirill has brought up numerous times in the podcast, that Putin is losing touch. He's increasingly isolated. And he's increasingly out of touch with the basic realities of the country that he's supposed to be governing. That it's a different country. It's not the same country that was out there in 2007. It's a much more sophisticated country now. It got sophisticated very, very quickly. Or these things were happening below the surface, and now they've become manifest. But do you see a danger in this isolation of Putin? Before we wrap up, I mean, how dangerous is an isolated, out of touch leader in this sense?
Well, there's two dangers. One of them is, as it were, the danger to Putin is precisely it means he handles the country far, far less well. You know, we've been commenting for months now about just how it's lost its ability to sort of manage public, and it's not just because of Surkov going. In some ways, that's a cause, but also an effect, a symptom. So, you know, it means that he's not as good a czar. But the second danger is precisely the extent to which Putin may well thus miscalculate the mood of the country, may well push when actually he shouldn't be pushing, may well effectively almost force the opposition into taking a tougher, more confrontational line than they otherwise would. I think precisely because this is not a man who knows whom he's dealing with, and therefore he's relying on not just his own preconceptions, but he's built a system around him that refeeds those preconceptions back to him, that actually increasingly squeezes out rival points of view. And in that respect, you know, he's like so many leaders. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about Gorbachev or Saddam Hussein, but precisely once leaders completely fail to understand their people, when crises come, they often miscalculate and mishandle them.
Yes, and it seems to be, and again, the people like Navalny that do understand the society, the more modern and sophisticated and differentiated society they're operating in. If you see the way they're messaging and the way they're conducting themselves. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today, Mark. We can go on with this forever, but I guess we'll be doing it in the weeks and months to come. I'd like to remind everybody that you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. On the line with me from New York City has been Mark Galeotti, professor at New York University and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Mark, as always, thanks for the great discussion. And I'd also like to thank our excellent producer, Tanya Koncheva. I'd also like to remind you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical podcast will take a brief hiatus next week, as I will also be on vacation. We'll be back in 2 weeks. And now I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.